Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, social justice from a Catholic perspective. Hear from the editor of the UK-based Justice magazine about preparations for the papal visit to Britain. Four masterpieces of high Renaissance art by Raphael travel to London for a free exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And English abbot Christopher Jamieson explains how to draw on monastic wisdom to find sanctuary in our hectic daily lives. With just a fortnight to go before Pope Benedict touches down in Scotland at the start of his four-day papal visit to Britain, the Catholic media has been working hard to prepare the ground and provide insight into the many different faces of the Church, its message and its mission. Amongst the newest publications is the Manchester-based Justice magazine, which is packed with information and features about climate change, fair trade and a wide array of other human rights issues seen from a Catholic perspective. Drawing deeply on the social teaching of the Church over the past century, the bi-monthly magazine has plenty of good news stories about unsung heroes and courageous communities battling against the odds for development or defence of the poor and marginalised. Plus, on the lighter side, some fair trade fashion and food pages, complete with glossy, full-colour illustrations.
The imagery in particular is one of the things I'm very keen on to really highlight, you know, the human nature and the human issues. They're at the heart of a lot of these stories that we're covering.
Lee Siggs is editor of Justice magazine, as well as news editor of the best-selling weekly Catholic paper, The Universe. I spoke with him from his Manchester office to find out more about the origins and aims of the magazine, as well as the challenges ahead in reporting on Pope Benedict's long-awaited visit to Britain.
I actually attend Mass at a parish in Sheffield in Yorkshire. It's a very vibrant parish, very well attended, and it's actually in an area where there are a lot of people lived as students when they came to Sheffield and stayed on in the area. They've now got young families. And what I kind of noticed really was that a lot of the Catholic papers, not just our own publications, they weren't really being picked up by the younger market. And really what, I didn't know whether it was because people are just losing interest in newspapers in general, or whether perhaps they don't have as much spare time and they can't, you know, devote the time to reading a publication on a weekly basis. So what I wanted to do was try and come up with an idea, a magazine that looked more contemporary, and also it's bi-monthly as well, so people can pick it up, leave it around the house, and, you know, dip in and out of it. So the kind of the core market really that I was aiming for was the sort of 30-something market, which is traditionally people that have been fairly interested in, you know, issues related to social justice.
So you began publishing in autumn 2009, didn't you? Has that been your main target audience up till now? Are those the kind of people who are, in fact, buying the magazine?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's quite hard to tell sometimes. We obviously need to do a bit more work on the demographic. At the moment, it's going out through parishes, and what I'm working quite hard on doing is trying to also promote it, you know, in universities, colleges, particularly the Catholic colleges that we have in the UK. And we've had some good feedback, not only from sort of the people in their 30s, but from teachers who said they've actually been using it within schools, going into some of the features, using them as case studies, and then following up and investigating issues more, using justice articles as a backdrop to what they might be covering in the curriculum.
As you say, you talk about social issues from a Catholic perspective, but would you say it could be appealing to a wider audience, a wider readership than just the Catholic readers?
I think it could, yeah. I mean, certainly we have a couple of freelance journalists that come into the office here to help out sometimes, you know, when the regular journalists are on holiday. And one guy in particular, he runs his own freelance business, and he has to commute quite a lot from Manchester up to Scotland. He's not a Catholic. He said if he saw this magazine in the newsstands, you know, and flick through it, he would actually be very interested in reading the articles. You know, some of the articles are more specific to the Catholic Church as an organisation, whereas other issues, you know, as it suggests, they're issues in wider society. So might be issues surrounding drugs or homelessness, and obviously a lot of the material that we cover comes from overseas as well. So anybody with an interest in international development, I think they would find articles of interest for them.
You do have a strong interest, particularly in problems in Africa, Latin America, Asia, don't you?
That's right, yeah. I mean, one of the great things so far has been the the willingness of the Catholic aid agencies to get involved with this project and to help out contributing material. So, for example, this feature on Haiti, there's a journalist that went out there and spent, I think, 5 or 6 days meeting people, seeing what's happening on the ground. And it's those kind of things, really, that have been very popular. A lot of the imagery that's provided by the Catholic aid agencies as well, you know, is a very high standard. And often it's an old cliche, but a picture does tell 1,000 words.
It's also true that through those agencies, like, for example, CAFOD or Progressio, the Catholic Church in Britain has taken on really a very high profile, hasn't it, regarding these kind of questions of international development over the past decades?
It has, yeah. And I think it's one of the most disappointing aspects, I think, sometimes of how the Church is viewed and its role in wider society. These agencies do some absolutely tremendous work on the ground. And it's something that, you know, the usual debates about the role of a religion in society, people arguing for it to take a back seat, people suggesting it should be a private issue. When they actually look at what these agencies are doing, the way they're helping communities, you know, not only sort of just dropping in after, you know, natural disasters, but there are individuals within the church, as we know, that are there for the long haul, that are supporting communities and have done over decades. You think about the people like Father Shay Cullen, who's a contributor to the universe, the work that he's been doing in the Philippines for years and years. And I think, if anything, obviously at the moment, sometimes we're preaching to the converted, if you like, in that the articles that we're covering are obviously relating to these Catholic aid agencies. And what I'm going to try and do is perhaps, you know, send out press releases to mainstream news agencies highlighting some of this work that's going on as a way of tackling the negative, you know, the negative outlook that people sometimes have on the church.
Yes, you've kind of answered my next question, which is the fact that the church does have such a particularly bad press in most of the secular press, I think it's fair to say, particularly in the wake of the current round of sex abuse crisis stories and so on. What else can you do, really, perhaps, to try and turn this around in some way through your publications?
Well, it's a very tall order. Like I said, the problem, perhaps, and I wouldn't just say it's in the UK, the people that are buying Catholic publications anywhere in the world are doing so probably because they're Catholic and because they sympathise or empathise with the views that they're expressed in those publications. It is very difficult. I know certainly our minds are focused on it in the UK at the moment with the impending visit of the Holy Father, that, you know, we really need to try and get out to the mainstream community what it is the Church actually does and why the papal visit to the UK is so important. The role that the church has in the world, certainly in terms of international development, caring for people suffering from AIDS, HIV. And very often the debate is it never gets off the ground. People have got a very biased view and the mainstream media doesn't help at all. So I know that there are sort of certain things that are being carried out in the run-up to the papal visit here to Britain to try and just show what the church actually does and what it's capable of doing and the vital role it plays in society. I think, you know, moving away from the international issues, certainly on the ground in the UK, if it wasn't for the church, there'd be so many people that would actually be slipping through the net of the, you know, the local authorities. It's the church groups that are there to help the homeless, to help people, you know, vulnerable people, people that are marginalised, asylum seekers, and nobody ever sees that. And perhaps they don't want to, but I think, you know, we just have to keep plugging away, really, and trying to let people know what it is we actually do.
Let's look ahead to that papal visit. I mean, what kind of coverage are you expecting to be giving over to that? Maybe at Justice Magazine, but also in The Universe. You're the news editor, aren't you, of The Universe as well?
Yes, that's right. What we've already been doing, I mean, we've been working very closely with the Bishops' Conference in both England and Wales and Scotland, and we're already doing a two-page spread every week in the run-up to the visit. And we're trying to get out some of the positive and the unusual stories as well, perhaps, you know, maybe the groundsman who's worked at a park for 30 years and is used to perhaps, you know, the ordinary jobs that a park groundsman might do, and now here he is preparing for a papal visit. But we're doing a very positive coverage, trying to just perhaps counter some of the negativity that's coming out of the secular press. I think it's always difficult, you know, that particularly like you mentioned earlier, the sex abuse has had a huge impact not only on wider society but on Catholics themselves, and we really need to just keep getting out the good that the church does, And hopefully our coverage will reflect that over the coming months.
During the visit itself, are you going to be doing any kind of special editions?
Yeah, I think the problem that we have, and it's one of the difficulties that I've found, I think any journalist that works on a weekly publication, whether it's Catholic or whether it's secular publications, that there's the issue of deadlines. And I think in terms of the universe, we've got an amazing distribution network that goes out to parishes throughout the UK and Ireland. But it's always run absolutely to the minute. There's the universe, we go to press on a Wednesday. The papers are picked up on Wednesday afternoon. And in terms of Ireland, they're taken straight to the ferry that goes over to Dublin. And then we have to, that all filters down through a parish network. And I find it incredible sometimes. I was down in West Cork, right down in the tip of Ireland a few years ago. And on Friday morning, there was this week's paper. And it's all done through this kind of parish network. The downside of that is something when you have, events like the papal visit, I think commencing on a Thursday, it would be impossible for us to actually get the ordinary week's paper out. So I think what we'll be doing, we've been working with the Bishops' Conference before the event. We actually published the kind of the official sort of preview publication for the Holy Father's visit, answering questions that people might have. So we did that, and that was provided free to parishes. And then certainly after the papal visit, I'd imagine we'd be looking to do another publication, obviously like a kind of a souvenir commemorative publication of the event. But actually covering it that week for us will be very, very difficult, other than via the website. And like every sort of news publication, that's something that we're looking to become involved with more and more. And I think with the onset of iPads and things like that, that's the way that it'll be going. And I think it's gives us a promising glimpse of the future, really, that where we perhaps struggle to produce a weekly paper to cover time-critical events, we can be up there with the daily papers once, more and more people are accessing their news digitally.
For the moment, just remind our listeners where they can get hold of news from The Universe and also from Justice magazine.
There's several ways, really. The Universe, in particular, is pretty much in around 2,000 parishes in the UK and Ireland. The main website for the company that covers some of our other titles as well that we do is totalcatholic.com. And Justice magazine as well is being stocked in the parishes. And you can also access that through totalcatholic.com. And then it has its own website, justicemagazine.co.uk, that again just links people through to the online store. With Justice, we're also stocking the title on, there's a couple of digital magazine websites, one called youdo.com and one called scribd.com. One's UK-based, one's based in the States, and people can actually buy the magazine on there and view it on their computer screen with a kind of a digital page flip effect. But yeah, I mean, other than that, it's through totalcatholic.com and then just navigate through to the store.
My thanks there to Lee Siggs, editor of the UK-based Justice magazine and best-selling weekly Catholic paper, The Universe. To celebrate Pope Benedict's arrival in Britain, the Vatican Museums have sent over on loan to London 4 of the 10 giant tapestries designed by the great Renaissance artist Raphael to hang in the Sistine Chapel on special liturgical feast days. Depicting events from the lives of Saints Peter and Paul, these masterpieces of High Renaissance art will be on display for free in the Victoria and Albert Museum, as my colleague Emma McCarthy reports.
Commissioned in 1515 by Pope Leo X, they were to cover the lower walls of the Sistine Chapel, below the frescoes depicting the life of Moses and the life of Christ, on occasions of great solemnity. Raphael set about designing cartoons or preliminary coloured drawings for all 10 tapestries, which were then sent to the workshop of Peter van Aelst in Brussels, one of the most renowned weavers of tapestries. By 1519, 7 of the 10 tapestries were complete, and to the delight of Pope Leo X, were put on display in the Sistine Chapel on St. Stephen's Day of the same year, causing many among the congregation to exclaim, "They could not have been made by human hand." But their beauty came at a cost. One single tapestry cost 5 times more than Michelangelo's entire ceiling. Indeed, so rare and priceless that 2 emperors sought them out as spoils of war, Charles V in 1527 during the sack of Rome, and Napoleon in 1798. Once, They were even used as a guarantee against a loan. So beautiful that replicas of Raphael's tapestries were commissioned by several European monarchs. For while the completed tapestries had been returned to the Vatican, Raphael's cartoons had remained with the weaver Van Elst in Brussels. So it was that in 1533 King Francis I ordered his own series to adorn his palace walls. Not to be outdone, less than 10 years later, King Henry VIII of England, shortly after his schism from Rome, commissioned copies made from Raphael's cartoons in Brussels. Then, in 1632, Charles I, Prince of Wales, had the cartoons brought from Brussels to England to have his own set woven in the Mortlake Tapestry Workshops. And they have remained in England ever since. The Vatican owns the tapestries. The cartoons belong to Queen Elizabeth II. Now, for the first time in 500 years, they will be reunited in a once-in-a-lifetime exhibition in London's historic Victoria and Albert Museum. To coincide with Pope Benedict XVI's visit to England and Wales, 4 of the 10 tapestries will be hung alongside their original cartoons. It's a joint effort by the Vatican Museums and the V&A to bring a little bit of the Vatican to England. And before, the 500-year-old tapestries were gently packaged up, ready to be shipped off on their journey, they were hung once more exactly where they were meant to be, in the Sistine Chapel. Well, I couldn't miss this opportunity, so one balmy July evening, I went along with a small group of art lovers through the great bronze doors of the Vatican and up the giant staircase to the tiny Sistine Chapel. And as I stood before the tapestry of St. Paul in prison, to my delight, Professor Arnold Nesselrath of the Vatican Museums was there to guide us through the cycle. One of the curators and organizers of the exhibition, together with V&A director Mark Jones, he pointed out that not even the divine Raphael got to see his cartoons and tapestries side by side.
It's the Holy Father's gift to the United Kingdom when he's bringing that exhibition to London. It will be the first time in 500 years that the cartoons, i.e. 7 paintings that have the same size as these tapestries, will hang next to the tapestries for which they're made, next to the end product. But tonight the tapestries have come back to the place which they were made for, and to be in a kind of painted symphony between the 15th century frescoes painted by the painters of Pope Leo X's father and Raphael's teachers and Michelangelo's ceiling. And this just demonstrates the cultural power that was in Rome at the beginning of the 16th century, created by these great popes.
It also underlines another aspect that's very important and integral to Pope Benedict's visit, and indeed the life of the Church, not only the Catholic Church, but the life of the British people, and that is their deep love and appreciation of culture.
But these tapestries are a kind of lingua franca, a common language that's accepted, that's actually copied by the English King Henry VIII immediately after the Anglican Schism. So Raphael's art can unite what has been divided by words.
A very interesting point is that this exhibition, which opens in September, when Pope Benedict will be in Great Britain, is free.
It's a real gift. They are the congiaria, like the Roman emperors, to the British people. It's a collaboration between Vatican institutions. Vatican Library wanted to contribute to this. The Master of Ceremonies is contributing to this. So it's actually the Vatican that's accompanying the Pope to the United Kingdom with a major cultural event. I must say, I mean, for me, it's a great experience. I've never organized anything that was so unanimously accepted by everybody who heard about it. And it is the Pope who makes this possible.
Thanks there to my colleague Emma McCarthy. Those tapestries and the cartoons will be on display for free in the Victoria and Albert Museum from September the 8th to October the 17th. Five steps for finding sanctuary. Five phrases for easy meditation. and how to apply ancient monastic wisdom to our whirlwind modern lives. In a nutshell, that's what you'll get if you pick up a copy of Finding Sanctuary by Abbot Christopher Jamieson, the former head of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey in the south of England. And if that name sounds familiar, well, so it should, because he's the man who featured in the TV show The Monastery, watched by over 3 million viewers when it was first broadcast on BBC Two in May 2005. The three-part programme followed five ordinary men who spent 40 days inside the monastery, living alongside the monks and learning about the Benedictine spirituality which shapes their daily lives. It was so popular that a follow-up programme has since been produced, together with a similar show tracking four women's experiences in a Poor Clare's convent nearby. Father Christopher's book, meanwhile, has become something of a bestseller, snapped up by people with no apparent interest in religion and no contact with any Christian church. So what's the secret of his success? Or is he selling out the faith, as some fear, by simply cashing in on public interest in New Age spirituality?
Look, the basic expectation is that we now live in a society where most people say, I'm not religious. But the good news is that they usually preface it by saying, or they usually add to that, but I am spiritual. And we have to start to show how religion is at the service of spirituality without an agenda, but rather we have a religious offering to feed the spiritual life of the spiritual people of this country.
With that key concept in mind, Father Christopher helped set up a website to cope with the huge interest sparked by the monastery TV programmes, and then set about writing a book to make the monastic tradition more accessible to non-religious readers.
The book was a result of an invitation from the excellent publisher, Weidenfeld & Nicholson. They began rather charmingly by saying, look, we don't normally publish religious books, although we did publish the works of the late Pope John Paul II, which was rather encouraging. But they said, we feel there is a space in the market here for a book coming through secular outlets, which is actually a religious book. And this was really very interesting and returns to the earlier theme. They felt that the market was saturated with the new spirituality movements, with new age therapies, with all of that. We all know about that stuff, so to speak. But they felt the monastery showed that actually those same people who buy those books are now open to classic religious insights. They no longer have to be coming from a new age source. And therefore they asked me to write a book from the classic Catholic monastic tradition, which might speak to the situation of people today. And they said, please begin with where people are today, and then show how the monastic tradition can enrich their spiritual lives and guide them on a path through that, as you did the people in the monastery. So I was thrilled to do that, and I learned a great deal about how to conduct this dialogue by an excellent editorial team who helped me to realise when I was using language that would not be accessible, and who helped me to understand what was going to be understood and what wasn't going to be understood. And that has been a great learning curve for me. When I'd finished the book, I was concerned by the question you asked earlier, have I actually dumbed down the tradition in some way? I was concerned about that. And so I sent it to a fellow abbot who is an incredibly able man who I've known for many, many years. In fact, knew him since we were both lay students together. And said to him, have I been faithful to the tradition? And he said, oh, yes, he said, I want to read this book out in my refectory for all the monks to hear. It would do them good. So I was really encouraged by that.
So who would you personally say the book is aimed at? I mean, is it more for the monks in their monasteries, or is it more for people, is it also for people who know nothing about religious life,
no,
or indeed the church?
It's specifically aimed for lay people, not for religious or priests. And it's specifically aimed for non-religious lay people. It is clearly directed towards the person who says, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. That's the focus. Those are the people who've been buying it. I discovered that it's now being sold in W.H. Smith because people have been going into W. H. Smith, which is, people need to know, is our standard high street news agents here in Britain, and asking for the book. You know, that's the kind of popularity it's had.
With all this new media interest, where do you find time to keep up the running of the community at Worth as well, I wonder?
Well, one of the things I've discovered about the media is that, funnily enough, the media is not something that's deeply intrusive into the monastic life. Provided you treat the media with respect, they treat you with respect. And I say to them, well, I'll see you next week. It's not like a news agenda. If you had a big news agenda running, then it does become more complex and you're under pressure. But when you, in a sense, have a message to communicate, which they're interested in hearing, then I negotiate and say, well, I can do it next week, but not this week. And a small TV camera crew is not particularly intrusive. If we can reach 3 million people through the presence of a production team of two, then, you know, that's a pretty good ratio. It's a way of communicating the gospel through the monastic tradition in an unobtrusive way.
I've seen your approach sometimes described as Benedict Light. I mean, have you had criticism, serious criticism, from people who think that perhaps you're taking a too modern, if we can call it, approach to the faith, that there is a risk inherent in this kind of dialogue with the modern world?
I think there's two responses to that. The first one is, I think it's only Benedict Light if it's read quickly. I think if the book is read slowly and at depth, then the whole of the tradition is implicitly present within it. And that's why I was encouraged by the response of other monks to the book. Secondly, the accusation of selling the tradition short is one that is usually made of those who succeed in engaging a new audience. I think the Bible is full of such examples, including our Lord himself, who got into great trouble with those who said he seemed to be selling the tradition short.
Future projects? Do you have anything in the offing after such a successful past year?
Well, the BBC are very engaged now in a whole new raft of religious broadcasting. They believe that the monastery represents a turning point in religious broadcasting in this country. They're talking about taking the book, finding sanctuary, monastic steps of everyday life, and seeing what happens when they give that book to ordinary people out there and filming their attempt to live out those steps in their day-to-day life and making that into a new documentary. I think that could be a fascinating project.
Abbot Christopher, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Philip.
Father Christopher Jamieson is the former head of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey, where the monastery TV programmes were made, and author of Finding Sanctuary, Monastic Steps for Everyday Life. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. Or don't forget, you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.